More now on the opposition candidate whose name has been chanted in recent protests, Mir Hossein Mousavi. This is from a demonstration last week. Mousavi is a former Iranian foreign minister and prime minister, a position that no longer exists. He is an architect by training and a painter, and as Mike Schuster just mentioned, we haven't heard a lot from him recently. What's his political background? What does he stand for? And what might he do next? For answers to those questions, we've asked two people. First, Joe Klein of Time magazine interviewed Mousavi in Tehran the day before the election and joins us now from New York. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And Mohsen Sazegari is a former deputy prime minister of Iran who's now a dissident living in exile in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
First, Joe Klein, your strongest impressions of Mir Hossein Mousavi.
Well, this was a very soft-spoken man. I interviewed him in a building that he had designed, which I think is a first for me in 40 years of covering presidential politics in various countries. He was very quiet, very polite, not very charismatic, but he did say several things that distinguished him even from some of the other reformers in terms of his willingness to negotiate with the United States if he were elected.
Did he seem to describe his campaign for president of Iran as one based on a different understanding of democracy or Islam in politics, or were his differences with Ahmadinejad more modest and more policy-oriented?
Well, I think the substantial difference was over the economy. Mousavi wanted to take the oil revenues and use it to invest in a more sophisticated economy of the future. Ahmadinejad has been taking the oil revenues and redistributing them directly. But there was also a difference in style. Ahmadinejad was directly attacking his opponents. He directly attacked Mousavi's backer, Hashemi Rafsanjani. But most important of all, he attacked Mousavi's wife. And that was one thing that got Mousavi's backup.
Mohsen Sazegari, you were, through the 1980s, almost still inside the Islamic Revolution. Your impressions of Mir Hossein Mousavi?
I remember Mir Hossein Mousavi from 1977 when I was a student at Chicago, Illinois, and an active member of Muslim Student Association. In a seminar that we had in Texas, he was invited with his wife from Iran. They had a very good speech about Quran, both of them, in that seminar.
About the Quran?
Yeah. And later when I was at the head of the biggest industrial organization of Iran during the 80s, while Mousavi was prime minister, I have worked with him. He's a nobleman.
A nobleman, you
say? Yes.
An intellectual?
Yes, he's an intellectual, and maybe I don't agree with some of his ideas right now. Somehow he believes in a kind of ideological version of Islam.
There's a report on CQPolitics.com this week that cites a couple of former U.S. Intelligence sources saying that Mousavi, back in the 80s, was very much involved in supporting attacks against the U.S., such as the attacks on the Marine barracks in Beirut or the attack on the U.S. naval base in Italy. Does that sound right to you, Mr. Sazegari? I mean, was he a backer of the relationship with Hezbollah, say, or no?
No, because Prime Minister was just at the head of the executive power and was not involved in Revolutionary Guard and Quds Force or Army of Iran and war affairs. Mousavi just supported, as the head of the government, the war. No, he was not involved in these affairs.
If I could just add, Mousavi is very much part, even if he wasn't directly responsible for Hezbollah activities and some of the other aggressive activities of the Iranian Revolution in the early days, he was very much part of the generation that made the revolution, people like Rafsanjani. And he's been part of the generational transformation that's taken place over time. They've become far more moderate. A lot of the people who took the American hostages at the embassy in 1979 have become leading reformers. And the real generation gap is in Iran is between people like Mousavi, the revolutionary generation, and people like Ahmadinejad, the generation that fought the Iran-Iraq War, who are far more military in their orientation.
Mohsen Sazegari, do you agree with that distinction, that generational division in Iranian politics?
Yes, my generation is generation of revolution. We were all revolutionary in those days. We were anti-US, anti-capitalism. We believed in socialistic ideas. And Mousavi, like many other people in my generation, we have changed our ideas somehow, more or less.
Joe Klein, the last word, the man who struck you as so utterly lacking in charisma when you interviewed him the day before the election, has his behavior since the election surprised you?
Absolutely. He seemed to be someone who was not the sort of guy who would get out in the streets with a speaker horn and lead a public movement.
Mohsen Sazegara, a former deputy prime minister of Iran, now living in Washington, and Joe Klein of Time magazine, thanks for joining us from New York. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, the Federal Reserve chose to hold interest rates near zero, and Fed members released a statement saying the pace of economic contraction is slowing. In other words, the recession may not be over, but it is easing. Not so much, though, that the Fed is ready to stop pumping huge amounts of money into the economy. It used to be that the Fed would simply push interest rates up or down. As NPR's John Idstey reports, the financial crisis has forced extreme measures that have some experts worried.
Frederick Mishkin resigned his position as a Federal Reserve Board governor last September, just before things got really interesting. He was around for the Fed's rescue of the investment bank Bear Stearns in March. Then, in September, the Fed rescued insurance giant AIG. Both actions were unprecedented. Mishkin puts it this way.
There's no question that the Fed has gone where the Federal Reserve has never gone before, the Bernanke Fed.
The Fed has flooded the economy with money to keep interest rates low, and it has also invented a variety of special programs to address the credit crisis, making money available for home and car loans, credit card and student loans, and business loans. Altogether, the Fed has injected over $1 trillion into the economy and could more than double that amount before the recession ends. There are costs and dangers associated with these policies, says Mishkin.
Absolutely. But the alternative is if they were not done, I think that we had a very good possibility we could have ended up with a depression. It could have been far, far worse.
So what are the dangers? Well, the Fed has already acknowledged losses on its loans to rescue Bear Stearns. It could suffer more losses on AIG, some experts think as much as $100 billion. But the big question is whether the Fed can withdraw the mountain of cash poured into the economy to support credit before it sparks a damaging bout of inflation. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says he's confident the Fed is up to the task. Former Governor Mishkin agrees. He says the big challenge is timing. The Fed doesn't want to step on the brakes too fast and abort a recovery, or stay on the accelerator too long and provide fuel for inflation.
This is uncharted waters. It's going to be more complicated. And this is why no central bank would want to get involved in these kind of activities unless it was an emergency situation.
Professor Alan Meltzer of Carnegie Mellon University is very skeptical. He doesn't think the Fed will be able to remove the massive stimulus from the economy before inflation erupts.
I have no reason to believe that that would happen because it's only happened once, and that was when Paul Volcker did it.
And former Fed Chairman Volcker had politics on his side. Back in the early 1980s, Volcker was able to raise interest rates sharply to curb inflation because the public saw inflation as the major economic problem. That won't be the case this time, says Meltzer, because to win the fight against inflation, the Fed will have to start stepping on the brakes while unemployment is still high.
Will the administration, the Congress, the business community, the labor unions, let them do that while the unemployment rate is still 7, 8, 9%?
The answer is no, says Meltzer. Even though the Fed is an independent agency, it won't be able to withstand the political pressures. Complicating this whole debate is the president's proposal to give the Fed additional responsibilities. The White House wants to make the central bank the so-called systemic regulator, giving it authority to oversee big interconnected financial firms whose failure could threaten the whole financial system. Former Governor Mishkin thinks the Fed's experience regulating bank holding companies gives it the expertise, but he says the Fed will need more resources. Alan Meltzer, who is writing a history of the Fed, thinks the central bank's track record as a regulator shows it often doesn't see trouble coming.
When the Continental Illinois Bank failed, Paul Volcker was out in a fishing camp. He learned about the crisis when the chairman of the bank came out and told him about it. Who's going to know more about the risks on the balance sheets of the bank, the regulator or the banker? I say the banker.
So, says Meltzer, the way to make sure a bank doesn't get so big it threatens the whole system is to penalize it by making it put aside more reserves against losses. That would make getting big less profitable. And it's an idea President Obama also has in his plan. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
Now to commentator Frank Dufford, who has some thoughts about an ongoing debate in professional tennis. We should warn you, this commentary contains sounds that may be upsetting to some listeners. You may want to remove small children and animals from close proximity to your radio.
Once again, grunting is an issue in women's tennis. Thanks to this unworldly sound emitted by a 16-year-old Portuguese player, one Michelle Larcher de Brito. Opponents have whined that this is distracting, which has in the past been a familiar complaint lodged against other female players, most recently Maria Sharapova and before her Monica Seles. Actually, I've never understood why these high-pitched sounds are called grunts. I always thought grunts were deep and guttural, like, if you will excuse me, grunt. Señorita Larcher de Brito is more of a shrieker, wouldn't you say? Actually, I always thought the best grunter of all was a Romanian player named Virginia Ruzic of the 1970s, whose shriek reminded one and all vicariously of ecstasy. Of course, what's the matter with a spot of noise in tennis, or golf for that matter? Why does everybody have to hush up to let an athlete serve a fuzzy ball all by herself, or to address a small dimpled one lying motionless in the grass, when someone like a baseball batter is expected to be able to concentrate sufficiently amidst a roaring din, able to hit a curved spheroid thrown toward him at 90 miles an hour? Of course, games played by individuals never produce the fervor of team sports. Good grief, team sports have yell leaders whose very purpose is to encourage commotion. Chants have become more common at our stadiums and arenas recently, often, I'm sorry to say, of a downright vulgar nature. But the fans at Fenway Park seem to be the most original, with a particularly miraculous capacity to suddenly engage the whole throng in cadence. A couple weeks ago, as Alex Rodriguez of the Yankees took to the plate, suddenly this vocal rolling thunder arose and spread throughout Fenway louder and louder. You do steroids, you do steroids. At the other extreme, the unnatural enforced silence for the poor golf fans has robbed them in particular of all original expression. All we ever hear in golf after a ball is struck is either, you the man, or in the hole. It's really terribly embarrassing for golf. Give me a good grunt on the tennis court any day, even if it isn't really a grunt. Listen, I may not remember much about the sounds of sport of 30 years ago, but the sensual cries of the long-forgotten Virginia Ruzic still sound like music to my ears. Ah! And at Wimbledon Monday, Larcher de Brito vehemently declared, nobody can tell me to stop grunting. Hey, as they say on the links, you the girl.
Frank Dufford, who only rarely accompanies his commentaries with grunts, joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. There's news today that means Hollywood's biggest night will be even longer. Next year, the Academy Awards will have 10 nominees for Best Picture, not five. The president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Sid Gannis, joins us from Beverly Hills to explain the decision. Mr. Gannis, why double the Best Picture nominees?
Well, first of all, I think the Hollywood's biggest night will be bigger, not necessarily longer.
Okay, well, that's a relief.
And we've been thinking about it for a while. For one thing, it does have a precedent. In the 1930s and 1940s, the Best Picture category had 10 nominees in it.
Right.
One of those years it had 12 nominees, another year it had 8 nominees. So we were going back to something we had done before. And the other reason is it felt to us that it would broaden the spectrum, open the nominating possibilities to movies in more genres. You know, a documentary film might be nominated for Best Picture. A big action movie might be nominated. God knows a comedy might be nominated. Unthinkable thing. Everybody says the Academy never nominates comedies. So those were among the reasons.
Well, 60-some years ago, when the Academy decided, you know, let's not do 10, let's do 5, there must have been a pretty good reason for it. It's been 5 ever since.
Yes, it has been 5 ever since 1944, I think. And I wondered about that. Actually, I went back into the minutes, because we do have the minutes from all those board meetings.
Lucky you.
We got them, but there was no clue exactly why they went to 5.
Uh-huh.
So, but it stayed 5 for years and years and years, and now we're back to 10. And who knows, maybe it'll be a very good thing. I have a feeling it will.
Well, you know, a cynic, and I'm not going to reveal whether I'm in this category, a cynic would say, I would have to think extremely hard to find 10 movies that I think were Oscar caliber for Best Picture from any given year.
Well, you know, of course, that there were 5 that people thought about for last year. But then people talked about, Academy members, voters, talked about other films that might have been nominated. People would say, well, why wasn't Iron Man nominated? I would have nominated Iron Man. Why wasn't Batman,
The Dark Knight
mm-hmm. nominated?
They wouldn't have a list of 5 they thought should be nominated. Maybe 1 or 2.
No, maybe. Maybe a foreign film might pop in somebody's thoughts as a picture that should be nominated. Who knows? There was a comedy that people talked about. People talked about Tropic Thunder. You know, it came up enough times for us to think this might be the right thing these days.
Well, there are going to be at least many more movie ads now that can trumpet nominated for Best Picture, at the very least.
Yes, they will. That's not our problem. You know, we're the arts organization. We're concerned with excellence, but, yep, I guess there's a business component to it as well. No hiding that.
And I still think the ceremony is going to be longer. If Billy Crystal comes back, that opening sequence is going to be huge. It'll go on forever. He's got to fit 10 movies in there.
He has to herald 10 movies, not 5. Well, we'll see. But we are going to do 10, and we're happy. We're really excited about that.
Well, Sid Gannis, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome, Melissa.
Sid Gannis, the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
Now, if you watched this news conference yesterday, you might have noticed that things looked a little different than the previous ones. It was supposed to be Mr. Obama's first news conference in the Rose Garden, but it was moved indoors because of the heat in the nation's capital. And it was held in the very cramped confines of the White House briefing room. The atmosphere inside, of course, also generated its own kind of heat. And joining us to talk about this and the evolving relationship between President Obama and the media is NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Hi, Juan.
Good morning, David.
So there was all this talk of this being out in the Rose Garden and the president's first outside. What happened? Why the change of venue?
Well, it was a beautiful sunny day in Washington, and it would have been quite a scene, with the Rose Garden and the Obama Children's Playground in the back. But the midday sun might have had the TV correspondents and the president drenched in their makeup, and so there was concern about camera angles as well, camera angles especially from the side that may have made the president look very much like he was not a cool guy, especially under pressure of questioning from the press corps.
I remember a lot of those sweaty occasions out in the Rose Garden. I'm sure a lot of people weren't unhappy about moving in. So we're 5 months into this presidency now, and And based on what you saw yesterday, is it fair to say that the reporters at the White House are starting to get a little restless?
I think that's right, David. You know, previous press conferences really featured President Obama in total masterful control of the press. He was professorial, masterfully kind of explaining things as if he was lecturing his students. Yesterday, less formality, much more give and take, with reporters pursuing the president and lots of follow-ups. Major Garrett of Fox News, one question saying, what took you so long in terms of condemning the Iranian regime? Jake Tapper of ABC following up, and then President Obama having to ask him if he's the ombudsman for the White House press corps. There was this sense of insistence that the president lay out, for example, what he would do to punish the Iranian regime. And the president responded by getting testy and saying, I know everybody here is on a 24-hour news cycle, but I'm not. And, of course, you heard in the earlier report where he says, what do you think, in response to a question about whether or not he was simply reacting to criticism coming from Republican senators. So even when it came to the issue of health care, the president was pressed time and again to explain the public option and found himself going on at length and feeling a little frustrated is what I sensed in listening to him.
Well, if we look back during the spring, I mean, President Obama spoke at a couple black tie dinners for correspondents, and he was kidding that journalists, helped to get him elected. I mean, was he sort of goading them at that point?
You know, I think it was just a matter of feeling overly confident. Just last Friday night at the radio and television correspondents dinner, he said that he had a problem. He was thinking it over and rolled over to ask Brian Williams, the NBC lead anchor, what he thought he should do. And of course, previously he said that, why hang out with celebrities when he can hang out with the people who made him one? Again, referring to the press in a very derisive tone. And earlier he said simply that the press had all voted for him. So that allowed critics on the right to say, here is a president who feels that the press is just falling down around his ankles and doing nothing and not being properly adversarial. I think the press feels that the White House press corps feels as if they're being taken and now is rising up and showing a little gumption.
Indeed. I mean, let's talk about where this president is in the brief time that we have left. And we have the Iranian election crisis. We've got some weaker economic news. We've been seeing Republicans, it seems like, getting some traction on health care issues. I mean, is the opposition starting to firm up and really present a tough case against the new White House?
Well, I think you can see it in the polls, David. What you see now is that the deficit and the question about whether or not the deficit would create more opportunities for tax hikes and inflation is becoming a big concern for the American people. Not popular to have bailed out General Motors. Questions about whether or not Guantanamo Bay should be closed by January. These are potential pitfalls, politically speaking, for the president, and the press is picking up on it.
All right, Juan, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for speaking to us.
You're welcome, David.
It's NPR news analyst Juan Williams.
If the House of Representatives does what President Obama wants it to do, it will pass a law this week that would be a milestone in efforts to restrict greenhouse gases. The president yesterday spoke of the pending legislation as an opportunity to develop new energy technologies.
The nation that leads in the creation of a clean energy economy will be the nation that leads the 21st century's global economy. That's what this legislation seeks to achieve. It's a bill that will open the door to a better future for this nation, and that's why I urge members of Congress to come together and pass it.
The idea that global warming is more attractive and saleable as an economic opportunity is an approach that's been championed by a tiny think tank in Oakland, California. NPR's Richard Harris paid a visit and spoke with the group's founders.
The Breakthrough Institute doesn't look like much, just a few offices and a shared suite in downtown Oakland. There are only 5 people on staff, and on a recent day, they were outnumbered by an incoming crop of 7 freshly minted college graduates who showed up for their summer internships.
Hey, guys, come on in.
Do you want to? Should we just sit?
What?
Are we going to stand right here?
Should we?
Yeah, we'll stand.
Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus founded the Breakthrough Institute in 2002. Schellenberger's 37 with a fashionable buzz cut. Nordhaus is 43 and so casual he hasn't even bothered to shave. Both wear jeans and loose shirts.
Welcome. All right, so yeah. I'm going to start. And really, this is
Well, this is your introduction to downtown
Oakland.
Once the sirens subside, Schellenberger and Nordhaus take a few minutes to lay out the philosophy of their think tank, in particular, their approach to climate change. Schellenberger tells the interns that environmental groups, like the ones he used to work for, are going about it all wrong. By urging Congress to cast carbon dioxide as a pollutant that needs to be controlled, they will constantly swim against the tide of public opinion.
We're stuck in this kind of poor paradigm for dealing with climate change, this pollution paradigm, not because environmentalists are failures, but actually because they were so successful. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the cap and trade on acid rain, these things worked really well.
But reducing carbon dioxide is a different story. It's not just a nuisance byproduct, it's unavoidable when we burn coal, oil, and natural gas. So getting rid of it means either capturing it or regulating it into oblivion. In theory, regulation will force companies to develop cleaner alternatives as the price of carbon pollution grows. But Schellenberger says that'll never work.
When was the last time human beings modernized our energy sources by making older power sources more expensive? And of course, by now, you probably know that the answer is never.
Likewise, personal computers didn't take off because there was a tax on typewriters, he says. And the internet didn't sprout up because the government made telegraphs more expensive.
So is there a better way to do this? Well, we think that there is. It's very simple. It's that we need to make clean energy cheap worldwide.
China will never stop burning its massive reserves of coal unless there's something cheap to replace them, he argues. And we aren't likely to stop burning coal either. Schellenberger and Nordhaus argue that the best way to develop these clean technologies is to increase federal energy research tenfold and to create a project akin to the Apollo mission to the moon. Schellenberger acknowledges that a massive increase in federal energy spending is not a popular idea at the moment.
There's this idea that the government shouldn't be involved in technology, the government shouldn't be picking winners and losers, which is sort of a funny thing to say. It's kind of like, well, why not? And when hasn't the United States government been involved in picking technology winners and losers?
He points to the computer industry as just one example of something that came into being because of deliberate federal investments. After the introductory meeting breaks up, Schellenberger and Nordhaus settle into a brown naugahyde couch in Ted's office to tell their story. They met as young adults, trying to save redwood trees on the California coast. Working as pollsters and strategists, they spent a lot of time figuring out what motivates people. That led them to rethink how to frame global warming as an issue.
The things that will drive or not drive action have nothing to do with how well you understand how fast the polar ice caps are melting.
Nordhaus says a sense of doom or shame only motivates a small segment of the public and puts off the rest. Instead, Schellenberger says their research shows that people are motivated when the issue is presented as an opportunity to revolutionize energy technology.
In fact, not only is it popular, but actually voters get excited about it. If you go and talk to folks in the Rust Belt in Ohio, or you talk to people in Silicon Valley, or you talk to people in New York, I mean, Americans love that, and they love it for, I think, reasons that are really specific to the national character, which is that that's what Americans do. We invent stuff. That is so much part of who we are, and it just seems kind of crazy that we wouldn't put that at the center of our policy agenda.
The downside of this, of course, is that global warming is a potential crisis, and critics say the solution offers no timetable for action and no assurances that technologies will be ready before the world tips into a dangerous new state. So they often hear that their approach is a distraction.
Well, I say, you know, look in the mirror here.
Nordhaus says the pollution paradigm isn't succeeding either. Most countries aren't keeping the lofty promises they made in international climate talks. And the 1,200-page climate legislation now before Congress is so full of escape clauses and giveaways, it's not clear exactly what it will achieve. One thing it won't do is dramatically increase federal research dollars. As a result, Nordhaus and Schellenberger rail against the bill in the blogosphere, and they're trying to get attention on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I'm taking off.
Hey man, good luck in D.C.
Hey, thanks, yeah.
A few days after our interview, we meet up again in front of the Dirksen Senate office building.
Hey, Richard. Greetings. Hi.
Long time no see.
Indeed. You actually have coats and ties, huh?
I know.
You got us on, like, maybe the 2 days a year I will put a tie on.
Schellenberger and Nordhaus came to town with a simple plea. The government needs to spend more money, not less, in developing radical new energy technologies and helping bring those to market. Today, they're accompanied by Peter Teague from the left-leaning Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Breakthrough Institute's main funder. Teague is pleased with what Schellenberger and Nordhaus have achieved to date.
The president has adopted their language, their message, the story that they helped to develop. The next stage is for the actual reality of the policy to reflect the glowing, wonderful, positive, visionary rhetoric.
Turning President Obama's rhetoric on energy opportunity into a fundamentally new approach to climate change will require a massive political shift. And that's the breakthrough that the Breakthrough Institute is hoping to achieve. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And if you'd like to learn more, you can watch a cartoon starring carbon at npr.org.